part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part.
Hey, Christian.
Hey, Javier.
Hey, good evening.
¿Cómo estás?
Muy bien, gracias.
Oh, qué bueno. Mucho gusto conocerte.
I'm like, oh, good, he speaks Spanish. I'll be able to do the interview.
Yeah, right.
I was really worried there for a second.
No, I'm half Colombian, so yes, I do speak Spanish.
Cool. Oh, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm one of those guys that sneaks up on you. I look Aryan, sort of German, Eastern European, and then people get like all freaked out.
Christian Horn? Yeah, definitely. I thought this guy was Bavarian or something. That's awesome.
Yeah, no. My father was Estonian and my mother's from Colombia. So yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, thank you for coming on to Part-Time Fanboy.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And I think I'm a full-time fanboy, so hopefully I'll fit, you know?
Well, I'm sure you are. I'm a full-time fanboy as well, but I have a life, a job.
I know, we got to sleep. I know, they told me I actually have to sleep and eat and, you know, like once in a while, like, all right.
Exactly. So, you know, I try and get the podcast up whenever I can.
Yep.
For anyone that's listening, you know, this is Part-Time Fanboy. My name is Christian Horn, and I have on the line Javier Hernandez. And he is the creator of would we say indie? I mean, should we still call it indie?
I get, you can call it indie or whatever. The comic book El Muerto and Maniac Priest and a lot of other titles. Yeah, I'm a DIY, I'm an independent publisher. You know, I do publish my own work through my own imprint, Los Comics. So, in that regard, it's definitely indie. But, you know, I think there's good as stories as you'll read anywhere. So
Well, it's actually funny. I mean, you know, we could get started with that. Well, I kind of want to go back to the beginning because I guess your beginning, like how did you get into comics? I mean, you're from LA, right? I mean, you're LA born and raised?
Literally born in East LA, like they wrote a song about me. And then I raised in a nearby town of Whittier.
Okay.
Most of my life. And so, you know, grew up in one of those, Mexican-American households, the parents speaking Spanish, watching Spanish TV programming. Dad listening to his mariachi records. And then me and the brother and sisters growing up with that. But also, I'm watching The $6 Million Man. I'm watching The Incredible Hulk. I'm watching Speed Racer.
Uh-huh.
As I flip through the channel now, I'll watch like some Spanish lucha libre wrestling here from Los Angeles.
Sure.
So it was like a bicultural upbringing, but definitely steeped in like classic 1970s, particularly Marvel comics. You know, I love that Bronze Age era of Marvel. So that's probably my biggest, probably shaped me so much as far as like the type of storyteller I'd later become.
Yeah. Did you remember like what some of your first exposure was? Because I always ask that of people. It sort of gives me a gauge of like where they're coming from. I mean, it's obviously Bronze Age, but do you sort of remember what was the first thing that sort of gave you your sort of addiction, as we all kind of have?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Oh, well, I've mentioned this before. People who've heard interviews with me will recognize this name. My older brother, Albert. He, at one point, he was buying comics, probably like 1968, 69, 70. And then he quit buying them for some reason. And then, so when I was about 8 years old, he gave me this little box of comics. Hey, you want these comics? I don't read them anymore. So I literally was reading, I guess that's late Silver Age Marvel DC comics. So I remember like John Romita Spider-Man, Jack Kirby was still doing Fantastic Four, or at least the stuff I read. I remember some Neil Adams Batman stories, the one with the Man Bat. My God, those were amazing.
Yeah.
And then I was exposed to like Steve Ditko through there was some Marvel Tales at the time, 25-cent big thick books, and they had, you know, reprints of the early Silver Age Ditko Spider-Man. So my education right off the top was like classic Silver Age, and then after I read those books. Numerous times I made my way to the local 7-Eleven about 1975 or so. And there on the spinner rack, all these 25-cent comics of the same characters with new artists. So I remember particularly, I think it's issue 37. I'm really bad with numbers, but Marvel Team Up. It was like Spider-Man and the Man-Wolf.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Gil Kane cover with Romita Inks, and the interior was, I think, Bill Mantlow, I think, and Sal Buscema on art. And anyway, it's like, wow, now I'm able to buy my own comic. You know, it's a special thing. I guess you still do it, where you can go to this, like a store every week and you're buying some comics and you go back the next week for the next batch. And it's like, this is something about, and then coming back every month, to like, you know, the next chapter of what particular book. It's amazing as kids how we could keep track of like maybe 15 storylines. Because if we're reading 15 comics, you read what, 18 pages, and you come back the next month, but you also read 17 other comics. So I don't know, it's kind of neat. I think it probably made a lot of us smarter in a way.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because, yeah, I know when I was younger, it had to be something that I really loved that I would stick with, but I would pick up like random stuff every once in a while too.
Right.
But
right.
I don't know that there were, I mean, other than like, I think I came in a bit later than you did. I was reading like John Byrne and
yep.
George Perez and all that stuff.
Yeah, these classics.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, but I do remember that there were only a certain number of titles because it's so weird. Like, comics were so cheap back then.
Yeah.
Even as a little kid, it was like you were still scrounging. I was scrounging for the couch, you know, like quarters and nickels and whatever to just try and get,
right.
you know, whatever I could, you know. So, yeah, it's really funny. You're absolutely right that when you're younger, you can keep track of everything. Now, today, it's like I can't. I'm lucky if I can, you know, pick up a trade and remember what happened, like, in that last book.
Yeah, exactly. Like 30 pages previously. Yeah, no, it's amazing. It really is it's interesting thing talking to people our age who bought the books monthly and how they kept track of it. But anyway, that could be like a whole topic or a whole book.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So was it those comics that got you into art specifically?
Well, let's go back one more time to my brother, Albert. So besides giving me comics, he used to keep a sketchbook and he used to do these like, he used to draw these, he was into sports. So he'd draw like these kind of slightly very cartoony, exaggerated sport players, you know, baseball guys, football, basketball. So, you know, again, here's like little 8-year-old me, whatever, like, oh, look, he drew. Oh, you drew that. So like, I want to draw. So I would start drawing superheroes.
Uh-huh.
So I got that from my brother, drawing and comics. And, you know, as I went through high school, you know, started taking art classes, college, and then eventually sometime later, yeah, I want to jump into self-publishing.
Yeah, well, so how does that sort of jump occur to you? I mean, what is it the thing that sort of inspires you? I mean, I know everyone sort of has their story, but were you trying to at some point like get in with the big two and then you just decided to do your own thing? Or was it something that you initially wanted to do like right from the outset?
Well, it's really interesting, and I won't try to get too political as far as the industry, but so through the 80s, you know, 84, graduate high school, and, you know, like you were saying, George Perez, Frank Miller, those guys were still inspiring me. And then, I, you know, went to college. Back then, there wasn't really, like, now people are so lucky nowadays, so many cartooning schools and comic schools that could go to, which is great.
Yeah.
There was a Cuber school as a kid, but that's in New York. That's on the other side of the world. So, you know, forget that.
Yeah.
So I'd be reading comics in the late 80s and I got turned off by Marvel, some of the artwork at that. You know, maybe after 13 years of reading solidly, you kind of get bored. But so I kind of got away from comic, at least Marvel, DC, and I started looking at independent stuff throughout their 90s. And so I never really wanted to work at Marvel. I mean, honestly, maybe as a kid, but some of it was reading like some of the treatment of like Kirby and some of the other guys, you know, this is probably throughout the 90s, I'm reading all this stuff and it just left a bad taste in my mouth.
Sure. Sure.
Again, I'm not trying to, you know, stir up bad feelings against these companies, but this is what I read as a kid and it turned out that's what happened. But
yeah,
so that just kind of, you know, killed it for me working for them, but I still like telling stories and making my own characters. So by the mid-90s, I am learning more about self-publishing and I'm hearing about, you know, what Cerebus and the Hernandez brothers doing, at least, you know, pitching something to Fantagraphics on their own. And I start reading about these other actually Mexican-American creators doing their own comics in the early 90s, mid-90s. Carlos Saldana does a book called Burrito. Richard Dominguez does a book called El Gato Negro. So that kind of inspired me, too. Kind of looking at it from like, okay, you know what? I looked at myself as a Mexican-American youth and wanting to kind of do something creator-owned. And if it's going to be creator-owned, you may as well do what you want without worrying about, you know, an editor or a marketing team saying that's not going to sell. So I wanted to do something, you know, in a cultural vein. So I kind of looked into Aztec mythology and Day of the Dead folklore. And I basically ended up coming with idea called El Muerto. So it's kind of like this long, I could say decades long process of just growing up as a kid and, you know, looking what's out there in the market and culture wise and wanting to create your own ideas, express your own ideas yourself. So self-publishing was a great vehicle for that. And for me, it still is. And for many other people.
Sure, sure. I mean, it's really funny because what I always wonder is, you know, I mean, I grew up on the East Coast. So, mm-hmm. And I think that you and I might have had a very different sort of like, what do we call it, Latin or Hispanic experience. Because right, I grew up in a very sort of, I grew up in New York City, which was kind of mixed and mixed heritage. But I mean, we ended up moving to New Jersey. And when I was really young, the only thing that you were really getting exposed to was like Eric Estrada or like Chico and the Man and stereotypes and stuff like that. Right. And it wasn't that I was ashamed of what I was. It's just like I didn't understand the cultural heritage that I came from. But it sounds like you had a family that sort of, I mean, not that my family didn't embrace that, but it sounds like you sort of were into that from the get-go, from the beginning. Like you had a family that celebrated that, right?
Yeah. Like I said, you know, both parents being Mexican, and you know, like I said, Spanish language TV was always on, and also being from, Los Angeles, New York, both great diverse cities, but there's something about Los Angeles. I think it's like the second highest Mexican population outside of Mexico. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of saturated here but it was such a natural thing for me. I mean, it's funny you mentioned Chico and the Man. You know, I was watching that as a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually for me, watching Chico and the Man, not Speed Racer, Speedy Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Even Gomez Adams on The Addams Family, even though it's played by a white guy, John Astin.
Yeah.
Like, as a kid, I just, like, how should I put it? I would just see that stuff. And it didn't stand out like, oh, they're Latino. But to me, it was so natural. Like, oh, of course he's going to speak Spanish to Morticia because he loves her. And, you know, his name's Gomez. And Speedy Gonzalez, okay, he's a little mouse, a Mexican super fast mouse. It was like a natural thing.
Yeah.
We can sit there and pick at it and say, are they stereotypes? Are they not? But, and there's validity to that. But at the same time, I'm able to like kind of look, flip the channels and see some type of, I don't know if it's representation, but you know, okay, they're also speaking Spanish like my parents, you know, so.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting because, I mean, it definitely, like you said, the Hernandez brothers and yourself, I mean, it seems like you saw that there was a lack of that diversity, you know, in comics, right? I mean, there were books that were out there, but I mean, honestly, it's like any time I ever read like a Marvel comic and a Latino character showed up, he'd be saying like "ay caramba" or something like that, something stereotypical like "ay ay ay" or whatever.
No, right.
And you would just be like cringing, and it just seems like you saw something that was not there, and you wanted to sort of fill that gap. Is that fair?
That's some of it. But also seeing these other people doing their work, it just kind of empowered me. Like, okay, it's a natural thing for a Mexican-American guy to do a book, you know, on Aztec mythology or Mexican wrestling or whatever. But also I did want to make sure if I'm going to put something out there, I wanted to have like a point of view of at least my stuff wasn't political, but like cultural, you know, let's show people there's other mythologies besides, you know, Hercules and all that. If I see one more Hercules movie, which I keep seeing, I'm all kill somebody.
That's so funny. Yeah. So, I mean, because El Muerto is the first sort of, is that the first book that you did or did you do something before that?
El Muerto was the first thing I was going to publish in 98, but the year before I was invited on some anthology these guys, some animators in LA, put together called, I'm very jealous of the title, it's called Hot Mexican Love Comics.
Okay.
I mean, isn't that something you want to own? Like, you want to own that title?
I think a lot of people want to do much more with that, with that title than own it. Sure.
Right, exactly. So I needed like a short, they go, hey, you want to contribute a short story? I was working on El Muerto, so I came up with this other character called Weapon Tex-Mex.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, this big burly, like, bounty hunter type guy. He wears like a Zorro mask, but he's got these two metallic bullhorns coming out of the side.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first thing I published. I got published in 97, and 98 is when I debuted my first complete self-published comic, El Muerto.
Okay, and how did that process, what sort of research did you, I mean, because things are so different, like you said earlier, things are different now. I mean, you've got the internet, you've got the, you know, you've got different channels of sort of distribution, Comixology, whatever, you know, that certain people can take advantage of. Not saying that that makes anything super easy, but I mean, things are slightly easier.
Right.
How did you go about in your research to, you know, say like, okay, I'm going to make my own book? Because it's one thing to say I'm going to make my own book, but then it's another thing to actually get it out there and, you know, get it to conventions or however else you were selling it, right?
Yeah, no, it's a huge step. I mean, I'm not patting my back or all the other self-publishers, but it is a huge amount of work, because it's not just creating something. Like a lot of the folks we meet are going to be creators. They can draw it, they can write it, but they really have no idea how to go about getting it printed and distributed. So I would just talk to friends of mine. A good friend of mine, Rafael Navarro, does a comic called Sonambulo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard of that. I don't think I've ever read it.
Yeah, masked Mexican wrestler turned private eye, and he's also working on a book called Guns A-Blazing with the writer Mike Wellman. So that's the current thing he's working on. But, you know, in the mid-90s, he was interested in, he had done some work for Marvel and I think DC, but he was also interested in doing his own publishing. So we just talked about it. We'd go to conventions. We'd go meet. We went up to ApeCon in San Jose one year in 96.
Oh, yeah.
To go meet Carlos Saldana, even though he's from LA. It's like, oh, he's going to be at that show with his burrito comic. And we went and talked to him about it. And he just says, hey, if you want to publish, go, just go do it. Get out there and do it.
Uh-huh.
Like, quit talking about it. And I learned that over the years. And like you alluded to, Christian, there's a lot of great stuff out there. There's Kickstarter. There's, you know, print on demand. You can just put it on the web. So a lot of good tools. But man, you know what? I don't care if in 20 years they have like instant hologram comics you can pop out of your head. If you don't have the, I don't know if it's the word, the backbone or the fire or whatever, to keep wanting to do your work regardless of obstacles, it doesn't matter how much technology is out there, how free it is to get it out there. You're not going to get it out there if you don't have that drive. That's what I've learned. I think that's one thing I learned over my 18 years in this comic biz self-publishing route. If, you know, because I see them at shows and I don't see them 2 years later. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's a tough racket. It's not cheap to get into. I mean, what were? Because I remember I did. You know, I've dabbled in it a little bit myself with friends. And you start to go just looking at the printing costs starting off, and then I remember learning that color was like extremely more expensive than black and white, and being like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So, like, how did you? Because I mean, you've kept doing it. I mean, but how many issues of El Muerto have been out?
So let's see. So there's three issues of El Muerto. There's this other comic I did, El Muerto versus Weapon Tex-Mex. I had to do my own, like, you know, Marvel always had the characters fighting out.
Yeah.
And I did this spinoff series called Manga Muerto, where it's kind of like this kind of slightly manga-styled drawn comic where El Muerto's this foreign exchange student in Japan and he's got a giant robot.
Gotcha.
Like, I didn't want to create a new character. I go, no, I just want to take Muerto, and I like the way it sounds, Manga Muerto, and I like the culture clash fusion of the name. So
sure.
But besides the El Muerto, I've done other things. I mean, I'll put out these like comics of other characters like the Coma or Weapon, the Coma, Dead Dinosaurio, Maniac Priest, one of the probably most recent one.
Yeah.
So I've been, you know, shifting gears and, you know, trying different things. And, but yeah, like I said, 18 years. I mean, the one thing I know, it's like, I just love telling the story. So it's not going to happen if I give up and I just sit down and don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you're not going to get the book out.
Yeah. But are you saying that in the 18 years that you've been doing it, there's only been 3 El Muerto books, and fourth one with the Manga Muerto?
The Manga Muerto was a collection. So that's 3, 4, and then the Weapon Tex-Mex and El Muerto. That's 5.
Gotcha. Yeah. But it's an idea it's safe to say that like you maybe take a break from because of other things, but the idea is to keep going on with it.
Yeah, that's the one I keep going back to. Like the other ones I've done, they're all kind of like one shots,
Sure.
One shot stories. But in fact, I'm doing this whole new, I hate to use the word reboot, but a retelling of the original Muerto story, and I'm eventually gonna put out all new material in the graphic novel, which should be out before the end of the year. So
yeah, which you actually sent to me and I read, and let me tell you, I really, really loved it. Like, I loved what you sent me. I've read Maniac Priest. I bought that as soon as I saw, because the way that I found out about Maniac Priest was that a friend of ours on Facebook posted about it, and I was like, hey, this looks interesting.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, and I was like, what is this? And then I ordered it, and then you were kind enough to actually send me the PDF of the El Muerto sort of, quote unquote reboot, not to use the Hollywood term.
I call it El Muerto Resurrection. That has that word hasn't been used. They call it reboot. So I thought resurrection is appropriate.
Yeah, no, and I have to say, I was really interested in it because I started reading it, and I really like your artwork, like the brushwork and everything. Everything's like very organic, but it was a very human story that develops over time, and you sort of, at least in this advanced PDF that you sent me, there was no sort of mystical or superheroic element as of yet, and I remember thinking to myself, like, when it ended, and this is going to sound kind of strange, like I really love this. I love this character development. I love getting to know this guy. I love getting to know his friends. I have this thing when I go see superhero movies where, like, let's say the perfect example for me was like Batman Begins, right? The first Christopher Nolan movie. I went to go see it, and I'm sitting in the theater, and they're doing all the Bruce Wayne stuff, like when he's a little kid, his parents are murdered, when he's growing up, and figuring out what he's gonna do. And then, like, as soon as he puts the Batman mask on it, and the sort of narrative shifts to like, okay, now we're gonna kick some ass,
Right.
I lost a certain amount of interest because I was so involved in the human aspect of it. And it taught me a really big lesson, which was that obviously we are young boys, we have testosterone, we're growing, and we like the action, we like the ladies, we like, I'm just saying, like, the things that sort of connect with maybe quote unquote your typical average teenage boys. But at the heart of it is the soul and the mind of the characters, and it was just really interesting to me reading this sort of resurrection book, how much I relearned that lesson, where I was like, hey, this is really good. And it's good because I connected to it on a human level.
Man, you're filling my heart with like light and warmth. Seriously. you're really touching on the fact that something I've always thought, like the original Spider-Man comics with Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, right? Peter Parker, and is working at the Bugle. He's got his first girlfriend, Betty Brant, and Aunt May. And I love this. Obviously, I love the Spider-Man superhero part of it. Sure. But I always thought, I go, you know what? These characters are so interesting. Peter Parker and his relationships and all that. I could read like a ton of books where he's not even where he never became Spider-Man.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I thought the same thing of Speed Racer cartoon as a kid. Well, maybe I got older. It's like, there's something about that family, his mom and pop, and then the young brother and his girlfriend and his friend, the mechanic. Like, there's something cool. Like, if they were never even got in racing, just the interaction of them. So I always thought I wanted to do a story where, and I'm glad I kept your interest through the whole book, because he doesn't really become El Muerto. That's just a preview book so far. It's just human drama, just people talking. There's no superpowers, there's no Aztec gods, yet, as you know what's going to happen. But I'm glad you picked up on that. And that's something I've always you know, wanted to see in comics, or at least when I started doing comics. So
yeah. So the plan with this is, I mean, you're going to, there's a convention coming up that you're going to, and you're going to be selling this advanced book.
It's going to be an actual printed comic. In fact, the convention I'm going to, it's actually one I co-founded. It's called the Latino Comics Expo.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's actually my convention. Me and my friend Ricardo Padilla, we co-founded this about, 4 or 5 years ago. And we're having our 5th annual one this year in Long Beach here in California. So yeah, it's been crazy trying to like organize this show and also trying to like finish 2 books at one time.
Yeah.
But I'm glad it's done. I'm glad it's out. It's coming back from the printer this week. And I'm talking to you about it. So it's all good.
No, that's great. And how large is the actual, like after the preview book, once you do the graphic novel, what's the plan? How many pages for the graphic novel?
Oh, I have most of the pages. Most of the pages are drawn in ink. Just a couple of pages need some works, but it's probably going to be at least 110 pages, I think.
Gotcha.
So it's the full, it's going to be like the full complete El Muerto origin story. So,
and for anyone who hasn't heard of El Muerto or doesn't know anything about, because we've kind of been talking about El Muerto and, you know, maybe somebody hasn't heard of it. What's sort of like the basic story?
Oh yeah, you're right. And then people say, what's that? Well, first of all, so everybody knows El Muerto means the dead one. So he's this young guy, Diego de la Muerte, turns 21. He was actually born on Day of the Dead, November 2nd. Mm-hmm. Which later on I found out that's Steve Ditko's birthday. So I thought that was that's some cool kismet, because he's like my favorite cartoonist. So he's born on Day of the Dead, which is Mexican holiday celebrating like the lives of people who've passed on. He's going to his birthday. He's going to a festival on his birthday. And on his way down there, he gets killed in a car accident and basically he's abducted and ends up in the land of the dead, the Aztec land of the dead, Mictlan, and the Aztec god of death kind of has a plan for him, turns him into like an avatar on Earth. And of course, Diego being good, in his heart, he fights against that. So he's definitely not like a dark hero or he's not a bad guy. He's obviously the good guy fighting against these dark forces, trying to control them.
Oh, so the dark, because I may have picked one of these up like way back in the day.
And right, yeah,
like
yeah.
I said to you, like I was like, oh, I don't know that I remember everything. And that's why you sent me the PDF. But so he is transformed by like forces of the dark that want him to do their bidding. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that sort of thing. Is that what you mean?
It's kind of like that. Yeah. There's two gods involved, actually. The god of death and the god of destiny. So there's some little things going on between those two gods. So
that's great. And it's sort of like a cosmic, mythical sort of tale as well.
Yeah. It's supernatural elements, obviously with the mythology. I mean, again, we can dig through my Marvel, history. It's got some, cosmic, some of that 70s cosmic, epicness about it. It's got the Jack Kirby stuff with, men and gods and mythology and, stuff like that. And, strands of spirituality and culture and, little bit macabre, little bit kooky, little bit ooky, kind of the Addams Family. Just a huge blend of, so much stuff I grew up with. And it's kind of funny how this happens to anybody, a writer or a filmmaker or a musician. I mean, there's so many strands from the stuff you're creating, back to your past, where you came from. So that's always interesting to follow this back sometimes.
And so when you were originally developing the comic, you had some success, like kind of right off the bat, right? Like you had a film made out of it.
Yeah, that was the first issue came out in 98. And then by 2001, I had done an interview on NPR.
Oh, wow.
It's like, wow. Right.
Based off of that one issue?
Yeah, it was just a photo. The first one was just a photocopied issue, by the way.
Wow.
Black and white.
Like a zine.
Yeah, wow. That's why I tell people, like, hey, if you're doing a DIY black and white, that's it. Don't work. That's fine. Just keep doing it.
Oh, wow.
And so I did an interview. It got aired. And then the director, future director, heard the interview. And, he wrote my name down. He got my contact info from the station. And then so this was like a couple year process. And then he put me in contact with him and a producer friend of his, and slowly made a deal. I got a lawyer and everything. And ended up getting Wilmer Valderrama from that 70s show, and I guess now from Dusk Till Dawn TV show, to play El Muerto, and that was filmed in 2000. God, that's old now. 2005, and film was released in 2007 after some film festival screenings and such, and then it came out on DVD.
Oh, so, wait. Is it on DVD? I wonder if I can get the DVD off of Netflix.
I don't know if it's still up on Netflix, to be honest. I know they rotate, you know, 10 million movies that they can't.
Yeah, but I have the disc account too, so maybe I can check there,
yeah.
Oh, that's cool. And so that must have been amazing for you. I mean, you make one sort of black and white zine kind of book, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh crap, I'm a player.
Purely on the, and I'm glad it was an independent film team, because I don't know what it is. The idea of having to deal with these huge studios. Yeah, I know it's more money, but it looks like you get more money to just stay the hell away from it. So I was involved with these guys throughout the whole process. I even told them before I signed, I go, you know, one of my concerns is that I signed the contract and then I don't see you guys. Like, you go off and go, no, you're part of our team. And, you know, I was an associate producer and I'd be on the set every day. And I put that in my contract. I told my lawyer, put that in the contract. I'm going to get paid to work on the film, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And not just like the option, like, you know, you get paid for that. But no, I want to work on it. Yeah, yeah. And again, for me, that was a huge, you know, I wasn't a filmmaker, never went to filmmaking school. But here I am going to a filmmaking course, basically. And they're using my comic as the... the study guide, whatever.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's interesting to me because one of the things you said earlier is about persistence. And I think, though, I mean, you're obviously persistent. You were working on your idea, but we're not talking about a book that was consistently coming out month to month or even year to year. It's just an idea that you fostered over time.
Yeah. And then, like, just by debuting that first issue, you know, the director, Brian, he called me in. He was just interested in it. He had a lot of questions, too, about the storyline.
Well, leading to sort of a larger maybe question, what is your opinion? Because the thing that tends to discourage people, you know, even people like me who have ideas and want to work on them, is that you have to have a book that comes out every month, you know, or if you're doing a webcomic, it has to come out every week.
Right.
And it has to be consistent, and it's got to be like a train, and it's got to keep moving, and it's something that has to keep growing, and it has to be out there in the marketplace. And if it's not out there in the marketplace, people aren't paying attention. But your sort of story is different than that, correct?
I've done interviews before, but that's yours is the first one to approach it from that angle, which is, yeah, that's actually observant because I'm here in LA, so. The comic was only in a couple of shops, maybe two or three shops. And some of those were just like Latino bookstores. But I know the comic, they looked for it at Meltdown Comics in Hollywood and it wasn't there. So they ended up writing me directly. And so they sent me like $7, right? For a couple of copies of the book.
Yeah.
And you're right. It wasn't something that was, you know, wasn't even like published as a comic. It was a photocopied, you know, I guess zine you can call it, but it was a comic, but just black and white photocopied. They liked the idea, you know. I guess if you're gonna make a movie, what do you have to base the movie on? A consistently selling monthly book, you know, which most of them are, I guess. Or is it just, this is a good idea to write a story about, you know?
Yeah, but I guess I'm not even talking about the movie because I feel like, you know, the thing that discourages people, myself included, is the fact that, I mean, it seems like the lesson to be learned from you, it's not even about like being a workhorse or like being a persistent. It's sort of like fostering your idea and believing in it and getting it out there at some point, but not necessarily having to have the pressure of like, damn it, you know, I got to have this in the shops every month.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, no, I get it. Okay, I would never encourage people to do that, like proceed that way. And then, you know, obviously Dave Sim would say, you maniac, you know, you've got to have, you know, that monthly book like I did for 30 years, whatever.
Yeah.
All I can speak of to my experience, what happened, and he already spoke to it. So, I mean, I would just tell people the perseverance part, is, I guess in my case, it wasn't cranking out monthly. It was just taking that issue to conventions and, you know, when I do, I don't know how many shows a year I would do, but be spread throughout the year. I'd go to different places. I'd go to like Mexican cultural festivals. I definitely go to Day of the Dead festivals with the book.
Oh, that's smart.
Oh yeah, but I mean, I'm the only comic book at most of these places, which is that's not bad, and it ties in with the cultural theme of the Day of the Dead. But I would go to comic shops, obviously, comic conventions. But yeah, it was just like, you know, taking that same book around all different places. I mean, you know, I guess it was you could call it a slow burn, because instead of hitting diamond distribution where the comic gets in every shop, I just, you know, every couple of months do another show, every couple of weeks, whatever. And even a small show, maybe a library show here, or maybe a little zine fest, you know, somewhere else. So, yeah, for me, it was a slow burn, but at the time, I was working full time.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, and I'm not trying. The thing is like, I'm not putting that down, you know.
Oh, no, I know.
Like, I'm very much impressed with that, because I feel like that there is very much an idea out there that you have to have something that is consistently coming out, instead of sort of like, have you ever heard of a book called like Hero Bear and the Kid?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember meeting like Mike Kunkel like at Comic-Con when the first issue came out, like at Comic-Con, and I bought the first issue and he signed it for me and stuff like that. And you didn't see the second issue for like a year till I went to Comic-Con the next year. And then you didn't see another issue. And it was just like, to me, that was kind of like bonkers. You know what I mean? But in a way, you know, it's sort of a different model, but it lets you sort of build your creation in a way that, you know, you can work your day job and still put it out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great way to, like I said, I don't tell people to proceed that way.
Yeah. But yeah.
It is a good way, like you're saying, to not get discouraged, because, hey, I only did the one book for the last 8 months. Oh, I'm going to quit now. So I took the opposite route. Now I'm not going to quit. It's been 8 months. Okay. There's still a few more shows I haven't sold this particular comic at. So again, I don't tell people this is the mat that you should take.
Sure.
It's just what I did. And you're right. It probably helped from discouraging me, you know, like crying in my own milk here. Like, oh, I don't have a book. I'm going to stop. Because you're right. I think that's what you're alluding to. That would stop a lot of people. So.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really great story. I mean, I think that's really encouraging in its own way, you know, and it really reminds me, and hopefully remind a lot of other people, that there's so many different ways of doing things, and
yes,
you don't have to get locked into a model just because you see success like someplace else. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, if we're going to be doing it this way, the slow burn way, we can't complain that we're not getting huge traction of huge audiences. So yeah, you gotta take it that way too. Cause hey, if you only got one book for 12 months, you know, you're either going to quit cause no one's buying it, you're not selling enough copies, or you're going to go, okay, well, I'll get to the next book when I get to it. I'm not asking anybody to cut me any special favors, or I'm not saying this is the publishing model that people should follow.
Yeah.
I'm just doing my own thing.
Yeah, and it's a reminder to everyone that you should sort of be creating the art for yourself first, and not necessarily any other considerations, you know, if it's not like your main source of income, which it seems like comics is not for a lot of people these days. So sadly,
you're right. Even the ones, if they're doing a monthly book, like self-publishing and, you know, whatever, bi-monthly or quarterly, and it's like, yeah, they're still working on it on their side of whatever else they're doing during the day.
That's great. I think that that's the biggest lesson to be learned from your story so far. I think that that's a great idea. Let's move on to Maniac Priest, because I'm curious as to, like, well, hey, I love El Muerto. So anyone who sees you at the convention should pick that up, because I love the book. I thought it was very heartfelt and a wonderful story. But now you've got Maniac Priest did it just come out, or?
Yeah, it came out, I think, in January, the book that you got, the one you ordered from Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's great. Like, we just sort of met on Facebook like a week ago or whatever. And
we
just have been interacting like slightly. But I am a sort of very big fan of sort of low budget.
Yep.
Late 70s, early 80s. I mean, even current day sort of stuff that embraces that, like Stranger Things, that thing that's like on Netflix right now, you know, of that sort of thing. So when I just saw the cover, you know, on Facebook that our friend had posted, Kiyoshi.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, he's a great guy. What's that?
I owe him because I got a couple of orders out of that.
That's great. Well, yeah. Either way, you know, I saw the cover and I saw Maniac Priest and I was like, hold on, this looks very interesting. And I ordered it right away off of Amazon.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I mean, it's very much up my alley. So why don't you tell people what Maniac Priest is?
Yeah. With the title like that, it hopefully it's the harkens to exploitation film, violent vigilante movies, Death Wish. It's a supernatural vigilante thriller. And basically in the story is a young priest, Polish-American priest, Father Janusz. And his sister and her daughter are horribly, violently murdered. And of course he is very angry and upset. And he's, you know, at one point we see him in the church at night yelling at God, you know, how terrible this is and it's not fair. And then of course, shortly thereafter, this mysterious man in black is, you know, slinking through the streets of Los Angeles, 1985, killing criminals with a flamethrower, with a shotgun. I mean, whatever, hangings.
Yeah.
And I don't make a big mystery out of it, but it's like, ooh, who's this? What's the connection between these two, the young priest and the vigilante killer?
Yeah. You
know, so that gives us Maniac Priest, but it's something I've been wanting to do for a while. And again, like you, my big thing is the Charles Bronson Death Wish movies. I mean, I love the original one. The sequels get sillier and crazier, but I enjoy them as well. Charles Bronson he's a great iconic, you know, person.
Sure.
And I've always loved the vigilante thriller. It's like it's a specific genre within the action genre, but you know, you got the Punisher from Marvel. Before that, you had these novels, and I read a ton of them as a kid. The Executioner by Mac by Don Pendleton.
Yeah, wasn't the Punisher based off of those? I think
he had to have been because he came a little after, and then you know they're both Vietnam vets and they're both waging war on the mafia. So
yeah, it's
just, yeah, absolutely has to be influenced by it. I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really great because your book sort of definitely embraces that sort of genre, but adds, again, a mystical element to it, seemingly, and is also not sort of PC at all, at least in the way it sort of approaches. I mean, it's not sacrilegious in any way, I don't think, but it's definitely not something that somebody in the Bible Belt's going to pick up and be like, hey, let's read this. You know what I mean?
No, right.
It treads a little bit of dangerous ground, would you say?
No, I would. And also, I will have to tell you, as the author of it, you know, you've read the book, and hopefully other people will pick it up and read it. You know, because so there's profanity in the book. That's a first for me in a book, actually, after all these years. And there's, I've always had action or whatever you want to call it, violence. And I mean, you're always going to have violence in comics. Mm-hmm. But this one is particularly gruesome because the murders, I have to get to keep that aesthetic of those 80s movies. And so I had to give this book, this is my first time ever I've had to do what says on the back here, Maniac Priest Book 1, Mature Readers, my first ever Mature Readers label. Because I kept going back and forth. I go, you know, it just doesn't work if I block out the bad words or if I, you know, hey, you friggin', you know, it's got to be what it is. So yeah. I got to tell you, as the author, you're kind of dancing on a tightrope and you're kind of afraid in one instance. On the other hand, when you're done with the book, writing it as the author, you feel so liberated. You know what I mean?
It's sure, like, sure.
This is the way the book has to be. It, you know, again, you can always, anyone can argue forever, oh, it's exploitative. It's, well, in the way it's supposed to be, in a way, but this is how people talk. These are criminals in the city. This is how the cops talk. You know, this is the way it has to be. So I've definitely got more books planned. In fact, I'm probably going to jump to book two after I put the El Muerto graphic novel out. I find it cleanses my palate really good. Like El Muerto's PG-13, whatever you want to call it, supernatural hero, da, 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 but Maniac Priest is a whole different animal and, you know, a whole different type of story. And, you know, I love it just as much. I mean, obviously you love all the stuff you create. So
yeah,
it's so good to get back to something like that, but I'm glad you enjoyed it. And people seem to be enjoying it the same reason you're enjoying it, you know, kind of keying in on the same elements.
Yeah. It's like you said, I mean, it really does embrace those sort of like that vigilante feel. And it's funny because one of the things that I thought was always a failure with sort of Marvel's like Punisher movies is that up until like this last season of Daredevil, I feel that they never fully embraced the nature of the character, because part of what makes those Death Wish movies work or something like, you know, Dirty Harry work. They were happening during the urban blight of the like late 70s, early 80s, where society, or at least New York or even LA, certain areas were like literally falling apart. Like crime was rampant. You know what I mean? You had poverty and stuff like that. But the other thing is that the crimes that were being committed, even in these movies like Death Wish, were so horrible.
Oh, they were terrible.
So horrific that you had to get the audience, or society even at that point, was on board. They were like, yeah, shoot that motherfucker. You know what I mean? Like, take them out in the most horrible way possible for what they've done. You know what I mean? And that's the thing that the Marvel movies never really, I mean, maybe Punisher Warzone a little bit, but the...
Yeah, I like that one the best of the three, actually, because it really... takes the brakes off.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely does in sort of like a fun, kind of crazy, off the wall way. But at the same time, the villains are still sort of caricatures of what they could be. And I think that where the sort of essence of those villains lies is in the reality of how horrible it is what they do. And you definitely do not, like, there's definitely some church moments in here where you've got like a child molester ring. And it's like, yeah, I want that guy dead. Like, not only do I want that guy dead, I want them killed in the most horrific way possible.
You're fine with his eyes getting gouged out and then he's flung out the three-story window. Yeah, no, right, exactly.
Exactly. Even me being sort of like the ultra-liberal that I am, it still plays to your sort of, you know, the sort of like baser instincts. And that's what's great about what you did in this book, because you can't make a vigilante story or a vengeance thriller, you know, like even something like Old Boy or something, without... it being absolutely horrifying what is done to either the main character or the people that the main character is tied to, right?
Right. No. Right. The heroes, the protagonist, his hands are going to be blackened with blood, but it shouldn't compare to the blood that was spilled by the villains.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or it could at least equal it, but it's kind of, like you said, quote unquote, justified, even if you're like a flaming liberal, like, okay, those guys were pretty horrible. don't tie up the court system with a 2-year trial for these cannibalistic Satanist or whatever, you know?
Exactly. Well, I love the design of the maniac priest, because in a way it's, I mean, not to give anything away, but it's a little bit sort of like Jekyll and Hyde or like the Hulk or something.
I love that's exactly, it's like the Hulk. That's, yeah, people are probably curious what you mean by that, but Shazam, you know.
Yeah. Where a character is transformed into this sort of like almost like Ghost Rider, spirit of vengeance sort of thing. You know, and how did you come up with the design? Because it looks a little like Frankenstein-y to me, or.
Wow, I love that. Well, we could do a whole, I'd love to talk one day, the whole panel on just costume design in comics. Okay, so you got a character called Maniac Priest. To me, the obvious thing is, okay, he's going to wear the priest, you know, the black pants, the black shirt with the white collar. That's like, okay, he's got to wear that.
Yeah.
Don't put him in body armor. Don't put him in the... So I did that. And what's he going to look like? Okay, he's got the shaggy... He basically... One of my friends did a pinup, and he made him look exactly like Charles Bronson. I go, well, that's kind of what I was going for. I didn't want to be so blatant about it. So he's a real huge guy, maybe, I don't know, 6'6" or something, and the shaggy hair... And I like that Frankenstein. That's good. You know, one of the visual cues I really stole from John Carpenter, one of my favorite directors, and one of my favorite films he's done, is The Fog. At the end of the film, when the pirates, they come in, you know, in the church, in the smoky fog, and you see these black silhouettes of these pirates, and then all you see is these burning red eyes in one of them.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
I mean, my God, the Carpenter and the cinematographer, those guys are so comic book in a good way.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that visual of, and I'm sure it's been done in a lot of things, but you can't beat two burning red eyes in a black shape. I mean,
well, have you ever seen a movie? I think it's called like Telly Savalas is in it, and Terror Train or something, or Horror Train. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, it's like a 70s, 80s. Is it Italian?
I think it's like a Hammer flick. And not Christopher Lee. The other guy's in it. Peter Cushing is in it. And it's basically, it's one of the very first horror movies I ever saw on TV. And it scared the living shit out of me. And it's basically they're on this train and it's going through like Siberia. I think it's like Russian. I haven't seen the movie in years. Wow. It's on Blu-ray. I actually want to buy it. And basically like anytime there's this creature or alien or something on the train, and anytime the lights, it disguises itself as another, as a human, and it kills the human. But then anytime the lights go out, the eyes turn red, and people that it's looking at, their eyes start bleeding, and it's like,
oh my
there's
God.
Music That's... in the background, and it's like, you know, and it, it scared the hell out of me. So this reminded me a little bit of that, which scared the heck out of me when I was a kid. And then it also reminded me, have you ever seen, I can't remember the title. I love Hammer movies and I always forget because there's always like Fear of Dracula or Death of Dracula.
Oh, Christopher Lee with the bleeding eyes. Come on, red eyes. There we go again.
Yeah. But but when the one time that he played Frankenstein, I think it's called Horror of Frankenstein or something.
Okay, right.
It's like his face is all scarred like that. That's what I meant, like when I said like Frankenstein.
Literally him, yeah. And also, I was thinking a little bit of The Exorcist because remember she had all those terrible lacerations on her face.
Yeah.
So he's also got these, which maybe people can want to know how he got them, or maybe it's not important. It's just a great look.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really fun book, and it definitely captures the essence of all that stuff, like from back in the day. I mean, it's definitely a book that kind of nailed it for me, and it's really funny because a lot of people, they meet me and like on first glance they probably think like, you know, I'm told that I look like Matt Damon a little bit, so it's like that white bread sort of white guy that's like, oh, he's probably some kind of frat boy, but like I love this sort of stuff. So when I saw the thing pop up on Facebook and it said Maniac Priest and it had the red eyes, I was like, oh yeah, I'm all about it. So
you had me at the red eyes. Awesome.
Definitely. So I mean, how far do you plan to go with Maniac Priest?
Well, that's interesting because I don't really plan things out. I mean, like I guess I know a lot of writers would have things mapped out up on the, you know, pinned up on the wall. Book one. I have like vague ideas that I want to do for each book.
Sure.
So if I may go up to 8 or 10, maybe we'll see.
Yeah. Oh, that's a lot. That's a lot. And why is the format so much larger? Because it's larger than a regular comic book.
You know what? I love this 8.5. It's 8.5 by 10, like magazine size.
Yeah.
Again, Marvel magazines from the 70s.
Oh,
I mean,
gotcha.
Yeah. And I've done like a trade paperback in this size. And I just love this size. It's just a little, like you said, a little bigger than a comic. It's not too huge like my beloved Treasury comics from the one you got up on your website.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I'll do a special collection one day like that size. But I like this. I don't know. I just like the size. It's nice and big. And I can work on bigger panels on the page. And, I have as much fun doing the story as it sounds like you got out of it. So, I mean, that's probably the best thing I could ask for. Like, okay, good. Someone enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed making it. So,
yeah, no, I mean, it was definitely a lot of fun. As soon as I opened up the book and I like got to the first page, I was like, all right, we're in for it. Like, this is going to be good because, I also just really like, it's interesting because I think the art style here is a little different than what you were doing with El Muerto, or at least the book that I saw. Like El Muerto, it seems a bit more sort of like raw brushwork, you know, right? What I'm saying, and this one seems a little more like I think it's still brushwork, but it is a little more refined, like a little bit more sort of tighter in a way.
That's very interesting. I'm flipping through the book right now and saying, I've done both these books you read. They were done this year. I'm wondering too, maybe it's because this one is colored. Maniac Priest is done with limited color, black and white, well, grayscale. And then I use red and blue in every story because red is the Maniac Priest eyeball. And then blue, I kind of use to for the young priest, his eyes.
Yeah.
So I have blue, red, and gray tone. And then for each story I do, there's four stories in this book, I get to use one other color. So the one with the Satanist, it's black, and I don't use blue in here, but I use yellow, and I can use, and I give myself the leeway. If I'm going to use yellow, I can use all shades of yellow, yeah, or if I use green. So it's limited color, but the way, because I can do any shade of gray, any shade of red, any shade of green or blue, whatever, it kind of looks like a big color palette in a way. But that's an interesting comment about the art, though. I would have to sit there and maybe compare them later on my own. And
yeah, it's just something that I kind of noticed. Yes.
No, that's
I mean, I love the look of both of them, but one of them I noticed, this one definitely seems like, you know how you could tell with the brush stroke, it's where it sort of tapers off. It seems like there's a bit more of that in El Muerto. And here it seems like a little, I don't want to say cartoony, but gosh, like an animated cell almost sort of thing. Like it's hard to explain. Which
I know. But I think a lot of it's probably the coloring that maybe. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's good. And like I said, it's exciting to do these things. And, you know, again, as the author of it, the creator, switching gears, because that's totally what this is. This is complete switch of gears from what the type of stories I do. You know, I do a lot of adventure superhero stuff, and I try to keep it, you know, not that I try to keep it PG-13, but I just try to, okay, let me try to keep it all ages. And I mean all ages, like 70s Marvel. They weren't, it's not like, you know, DC, I'm not criticizing it, but DC in the 90s, they'd have like the Batman animated.
Yeah, comic. Yeah.
Like that was obviously written, okay, write it for kids. Make sure it's for kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Art's kind of more cartoony and the dialogue's not really harsh. I'm talking about Marvel in the 70s. Me, an 8-year-old kid, could read an issue of Ghost Rider or Son of Satan or Dracula, which is dark and gothic, but a college kid or someone in their 30s could read it. We all three of us could read it, and it was pretty much okay still for me as a kid, you know, quote unquote okay for, you know, as far as content. So
sure,
I kind of like that aesthetic of keeping your books. Maybe I should call it general audience, because you say all ages, it sounds like you're dumbing it down and kind of make it more cutesy for kids. It's like, you know, I think kids are a little more capable of reading. I mean, some of the stuff they watch on in the movies, not even rated R stuff, but Harry Potter, those are PG-13, but they can be pretty dark and, you know, they're pretty, they can be pretty heavy experiences in the
theater. Well, so when you can't go see a Batman Superman movie for fear of your kids not being able to, there's definitely something wrong. So,
right.
But that's not Maniac Priest. Are you talking El Muerto would be more sort of general audiences?
Yeah, I would think so. Although there's the whole thing when it gets his heart ripped out. But I go, hey, that's a historical thing, man. I don't know.
Well, it's also in Temple of Doom, right? So
There we go.
Well, you know, I mean, I've got you here for almost an hour. I've kept you here for almost an hour. But I did want to ask you, it says on the inside cover of Maniac Priest, it says dedicated to Frank Miller and John Carpenter. You've already kind of like touched on that. But then you say, plus acknowledgments to the works of God. Are you religious?
I'm a good Catholic, or a so-so good Catholic, but I put that in there because obviously a lot of the stuff, you know, I was thinking of Old Testament God, where he'd wipe out a whole city or whatever.
Definitely.
This is definitely like the angel of death.
This guy's not hanging out with the big J. No,
right, this is like wrath of God type of stuff.
You'll notice
Frank Miller and Carpenter got top billing over God.
That's hysterical. That's so funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I love both of the books. I mean, I thought that it was fantastic. I paid for Maniac Priest because you were like, oh, I'm going to send a PDF. And I was like, no. I want to pay for it because comics cost money. And you can get this, you can get Maniac Priest on Amazon, right?
Yeah. Folks can order it directly and I'll get my cut out of there.
Oh, but, that's great.
I mean, I love, you know, even though I gave you the digital copy and such, I just love print. I love that people, I mean, I love holding a book in my hand and flipping through it. And
yeah, me too.
I know it's old fashioned, and as the years go on, we're going to be more and more minority, but I don't care. There's still print options. In fact, there's more print options now than ever. hell, now Amazon's got into the printing industry. So yeah, let's print the books and flip through it, enjoy it, flip back and forth. Don't scroll up and down on your iPad, whatever.
Well, do both. Yeah, whichever one gives you money.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. I got to put a Kindle version out.
Don't be a hater.
be a participator and buy my books.
Great. Okay, so what's the convention that you're running and that you're going to be at again?
Yeah, so that's upcoming. The Latino Comics Expo is going to be happening in Long Beach at the Museum of Latin American Art.
When is that?
August 6th and 7th.
Okay, cool. Oh, wow, that's great. And what is your website? Is it...
folks can go to my primary site is Javzilla.com, JAVZILLA.com. If you want to jump right to El Muerto, just go to elmuerto.com. That's where I post all just El Muerto stuff.
Gotcha.
Elmuerto.com.
That's great. And your imprint is called Los Comics.
Los Comics, yes. That was the first thing I thought of when I had it self-published. I go, okay, let me put the mechs in comics. So
yeah, that's great.
That hasn't changed since.
Well, I love both these books. When you come out with the graphic novel of El Muerto, I'm definitely, let me know and I will pick it up and read it. I really enjoyed what I read so far, and I really enjoyed Maniac Priest. Like, I really, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, stuff that's just like outside of the box, reminiscent of like the late 70s, early 80s, and you like, you know, the spirits of vengeance causing havoc, Maniac Priest is definitely the book for you. Thank you for coming on to Part-Time Fanboy, Javier.
Well, Christian, thanks so much for having me. I mean, it's been great talking. You had some great insights. It's always good to do interviews, and I'll be honest, some are better than others. This was a really good one. You're very insightful, and I think it makes for good conversation. So hopefully your listeners will enjoy this episode of Part-Time Fanboy.
I'm sure they will. And, you know, thanks for coming on. And once again, I am Christian Horn. This has been Part-Time Fanboy. I have been on the line with Javier Hernandez. And go check his stuff out. And in the meantime, you know, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, you know, whatever, all that other fancy stuff that I never follow up on. Thank you for listening. And thanks for being on, Javier. I really appreciate it. Cool.
Part-Time Fanboy.